This interview is with Mr. Paul Stanley Hershey, Sr., who is presently working at the University of Illinois. Mr. Hershey was the former owner of the Lincoln Bindery in Urbana and served two terms on the Urbana Council. He was born here in Urbana in July 1930. This interview is being conducted on August 1st, 1983 at 505 East Green, Champaign. The interviewers are Melinda Roundtree and Patrick Tyler, representing the Urbana Free Library Archives Department. This tape is part one of a two-part series.
Okay, first of all, Mr. Hershey, could you tell me a little about your childhood, the real place where you were born?
All right, I was born in Urbana, Illinois, 706 North Romine, and attended Urbana schools. At the time that I went to school in Urbana, what is now King School was Hayes School. What is now the Thornburn, and I don't know what they call it, it's a place for recreation and elderly people. That was the junior high school. And the Urbana High School, as it is now, is as it was when I went to school. There was the junior high school was a two-year junior high school. You went 1 through 6 in grade school, 7 and 8 in the junior high school, and 9 through 12 at the senior high school.
Could you tell me some of the childhood experiences? What is one of some things that you can remember that happened?
Well, that's been a few years ago. When I started the school, Hayes School at that time was a totally integrated school. In fact, the neighborhood in which I lived in was a totally integrated neighborhood. And if I can remember correctly, there may have been 6 or 8 kids, black kids, in my sixth grade class. Moved on to the junior high school, and of course at the junior high school, kids from all over the school district attended the junior high school. Now, there were some problems there because many of the kids who lived in the outlying neighborhoods had never come in contact with blacks. I remember in particular an incident. We had a young fellow who had moved to Urbana from North Dakota, and if you're familiar with the grounds at Thornburn, at that time Thornburn Junior High School, was a bone ditch. And what we used to do, the boys used to get out and kick a soccer ball across the bone ditch. And this particular day, I was out there playing, and the fellow's name was Neil Huber. And I kicked the ball across the bone ditch, and of course the common word at that time was nigger. And he made a statement about kick the ball across the bone ditch, nigger, and of course that was a fighting word at that time also. And we had a confrontation. My eighth grade year at Farmer Junior High School, I ran for class president and was elected class president. Had some difficulty. The principal at that time was a gentleman by the name of A.H. Lochner. And in the history of the Urbana School District, there had never been a black class president at the junior high school level. One of the things that you do as class president is to deliver the graduation address. And he put off giving me what was the graduation address for an extended period of time until my father and mother became involved, and then finally I got the copy of the address, and I did deliver the graduation address at the 8th grade graduation. And all through my junior high and high school days, I participated in athletics. As a freshman in high school, I was elected vice president of the freshman class. I then didn't run again for any class office until my senior year, and I ran for president again and was defeated my senior year in high school. But I was on the honor roll all through high school. It was fairly different. During those times, all the schools, at least in the area in which black people lived, the schools were integrated. And then, of course, you went to the junior high and senior high schools, and naturally both of those were integrated. Probably at that age, I wasn't as aware of prejudice, segregation as I became after I finished high school. And I think you'll find that in a community such as Champaign-Urbana, that the prejudices are more subtle. You don't really recognize that they're there because the people that you're dealing with have a different manner in which they are prejudiced towards you. You know, as I understand, being in service in the 50s and having been stationed in the South, it's fairly clear what you can and cannot do. That's not true in a community like Champaign-Urbana.
Could you tell me a little bit about your family background, your parents, what they did?
All right, my mother was born in Columbia, Tennessee. My father in Oklahoma, Mississippi. They moved here to Champaign-Urbana sometimes 1914, 1915. I have four brothers and three sisters. There were eight children in the family. My mother, for a long period of time, cooked at the AKA sorority house. My father had several jobs. I remember he worked for Goodyear for a period of time. He then came to work here at the university and worked in the food service area. And after working in the food service area, moved to the building service area, and in fact was the first black janitor hired here at the university. I don't know what else you want to know.
Okay. Well, could you give me the names of your sisters and brothers?
All right. I have, as I said, I have four brothers. The youngest, Julius, and I'm next to the youngest. Next brother is David, and he passed in 4 years ago. Next brother is George, and my oldest brother is Charles. My oldest sister is Mary, and next to her is Dorothy, and my youngest sister is Betty.
Okay, some of the people that we talked to in our interviews, they said something about the segregation that existed in the theaters here in Champaign-Urbana. Did you find it,
Yeah, it used to be when you went to the movie, you had to sit in the balcony, and that was true throughout the two communities. In fact, there was a period of time when we didn't even go to what at that time was called the Princess Theater in Urbana. You went to the Orpheum or the Virginia or the Rialto Theater in Champaign. You always sat in the balcony. That's why I say, there were subtle kinds of prejudices and segregation at that time. In fact, up until, I would say, the early 50s, you didn't eat in restaurants here on campus, nor did you live in any of the student dorms. Black students here at the university up until the early 50s lived in the community. And in fact, my parents rented, we had a fairly large house, and my oldest sister, for the purposes of providing income for my parents, had split off one portion of the house, and that portion was rented out to three female students here at the university. But that was that was common in those days.
Now I want to get a little bit into your past employments. Could you tell me the different jobs that you have held here in Champaign-Urbana?
All right, I started working at a very early age, setting pins. I was 10 years old, setting pins at what was called a duck pin bowling alley here on the campus. In fact, it was right below this office here. And I also worked for McBride's drugstore as a stock boy. During those period of times, if you made 25 cents an hour, that was good money. And when When I first started working for Mr. McBride, I was paid 25 cents an hour, and then he moved me to 35 cents an hour. Setting pins, you earn 3 cents a line, that's 10 frames. I doubled up. I would set pins on the weekend, and after school, would work at McBride's drugstore. When I graduated, I worked for McBride all the way through high school. I graduated from high school, and I entered University of Illinois. I did not work, as I can recall. I then got drafted, went into service. I was trained at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, then went to Fort Benning, Georgia through Officers Candidate School, and was commissioned in 1952, a second lieutenant. Stayed in service approximately 33 months, came back out of service. Well, during that period of time, prior to going to service, I did work for Newman Foundation as a kitchen helper.
It's not here anymore?
It's still here, right. Newman Hall, it's on the corner of 6th and Armory. But I worked in there as a kitchen laborer. When I got out of service, I went back to school. I also got married, and I went back to work at Newman Hall and worked there for about 16 years. In 1960, when I got out of service, I got employed as assistant director of Douglas Center. At that time, Lee Carey was director. That summer, I also worked over in Danville at the foundry in Danville. I then became director of Douglas Center in 1954 and served as director until 1960. And in 1960, I came to the university as a mail messenger and worked here for 6 years, to 1966. I was then appointed director of the poverty program for Champaign County, and I stayed there for 1 year. Then came back to the university as a personnel officer, recruiter, and have been at the university since then. Except for one period of time, from 69, April of, November of 69 to April of 71, my wife and I purchased a Lincoln Press bookbindery and went into business. And it was very clear to me that we weren't turning over the books quickly enough to take care of my family, so then I came back to the university, and I've been at the university since then.
What did you study at U of I?
Well, it's a long story. I have yet to complete my bachelor's. I'm 9 hours from a bachelor's degree, and being 53 years old, I don't think that I'll ever finish. I would not advise any young person to do what I did. I was fortunate. I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and had potential and showed capability and was given the opportunity. But while here, I majored in history and minored in sociology. Take some courses through the Labor Institute, because my position here at the university now is Associate Director of Labor Relations. And so I felt it necessary to take some courses to give me some background in labor law, labor history, so I did take those courses. But for the most part, I'm self-taught in that specific area. Negotiations, employee relations, and that aspect of labor.
I understand that you were on the Urbana City Council for a while, right?
That's true.
That your experiences in school, you know, earlier school, helped influence you to go into that? Or you just have
not really. In 1962, we built our home on Ellis Drive. And having been born and raised in Urbana, I knew a great deal about the people and the community. Well, when we moved into our new home, there were some older houses behind our new home, and obviously they were very poorly kept, and primarily because these older homes were owned by white landowners who really didn't give a damn about what happened as far as the black people that lived there were concerned. And as a result, they would come outside and throw dirt, garbage, anything. And there must have been a pile of debris some 20 feet high behind my house. At that time, Don Harlow, who had been alderman for years, was our alderman, and I went to Don. Don had watched me go through grade school, junior high, and high school, and well, the whole family, in fact. He had a gas station on the corner of Goodwin and Hill Street. And having gone to Hayes School, all the black kids had go by his gas station. So I went to Don and asked Don to see if the city would not remove that debris from behind my house. Don advised me that he could talk to, he's blue in the face, and as far as our area was concerned, they wouldn't do anything. And so at that point in time, my wife and I began to go to city council meetings. It was very strange. At that time, the city council was in an old community building, and the chairs were those chairs from the 1880s and 1890s, straight back wooden chairs. City council chambers still had spittoons sitting on the floors, and it was really a strange place, but that didn't deter us from going. And we brought this to the attention of the city council. As my wife and I continued to go, we gathered some force from other people in the community. And I decided if I had to go and represent myself at a city council meeting, I might as well run for alderman. I had the support of the people. I had the support from most of the people. Strangely enough, in the 60s, many of our black people were still Republicans. And I guess lived on that theory that Lincoln freed the slaves and we owe so much to the Republican Party, which was a facade as far as I was concerned. I ran on the Democratic ticket. Well, I was told by many black people that I could never beat Don Harlow, because Don had been in office for 16 years. And I guess I said, you know, you never know if you don't try. So I ran for alderman. I defeated the Democratic fellow in the primary, and then when the general election came, we also had not only the city election but a county election, and if I'm not mistaken, there might have been a school board election at that time also. But I beat Don Harlow by 8 votes. In the third ward in which I live, black people really would band together. They have enough votes in that third ward to do almost anything they want to do. But there's an educational process that you have to go through also, because as I say, during that period of time, there were still quite a few blacks who were Republicans, and I'm not saying being a Republican is bad, but in you've got to look at the candidates, in my opinion, and select a candidate that's going to do for you what needs to be done. And they can be on either side of the fence as far as party is concerned. But historically, that's the way black people had voted in the third ward, and some of the people that I had grown up with and some of the people who were very close friends of the family were carting other black people to the polls to vote for what they thought was Don Harlow, but in fact they were voting for me, and would tell me when they came out of the voting polls, you know, so-and-so brought me here, but I voted for you. It was a real experience. When I first got on the council, there were 14 aldermen, 4 Democrats out of the 14, 10 Republicans, and I was the only black. And I found it very difficult to get things done, and primarily because it was a new experience for everybody else as well. I tried initially to go behind closed doors to resolve issues and found out very quickly that it didn't work. So what I did basically at every council meeting, I would have my agenda and I would get up publicly and say what I wanted to say so that the news media picked it up, and that way we got some things done. For an example, a fellow by the name of Henson, C.T. Henson, and his son Max, who at that time the university was going through a rebuilding program here, the computer science building, the civil engineer building, and there were older homes that were located on those spots. And these two gentlemen purchased those homes for $100, $200, moved them into an area, which you probably know, Washer Drive, broke those houses up into 3-4 apartments, and charged exorbitant rents to black people. Our house moving ordinance dated back to the 1860s, and they talked about rubber tires and horse-drawn house moving equipment, and that was one of the major things that I pursued at that time, because I felt that black people were being taken advantage of, and the only way that we were going to curtail that kind of movement was to, one, rewrite our house moving ordinance, make it more stringent as far as purchase, make it more stringent as far as moving houses into area and how they into other areas and how they fit into that specific area. And we did accomplish that. And, I recall that at one time they were moving 3 houses at one time, and we blocked the streets. We formed what was known as the Hayes School Neighborhood Association back in 1964, 65. There were a select group of people who were in that association, who did the work in that association. And they were moving the 3 houses. We had met, I think, the week before, because we had been to the city council and asked them to, one, start sweeping our streets and so forth and so on. Well, they came up and put signs up. This was about a month before they moved the 3 houses, and we thought that they were putting signs up to keep us from parking in the streets so that they could sweep the streets. But to our amazement, we woke up one morning, they were moving 2 houses through the area. So the next time they put the signs up, we had a meeting and determined that when everybody went to work that next morning, we were going to legally park our cars in the street and lock our cars, because we knew that if we were parked legally and the cars were locked, that they could move them without a lot of trouble. And that's exactly what happened the second time. We looked up, here comes 3 houses. Well, Romine at that time was only completed to Tremont. And we had both sides of Romine blocked. We had both sides of Ellis Drive blocked. And that was the only way that they could get around and go through to Goodman and up Bradley over to Washer Drive. And it required the movers, who were the Henson brother and son, son and father. We figured it must have cost them an additional $3,500, $4,000, because what they had to do was to call out Twin City Radiator and Shelby Motors, and they had to go up underneath the cars and disconnect the transmissions and to move the cars, and that required a great deal of time. We had it was a real difficult period, because the police officer that came out, we had them blocked right there where my house is, and the police officer came out I'd gone to school with, and he asked me if there was going to be trouble, and of course I said, you know, not unless they try to move the houses, and they declared an emergency, the city declared an emergency, and that's how they moved all the cars. Then you have to be aware of the fact that the same association in 1966, Hayes School Neighbor Association, during the period of time when I went to school in 1966, Hayes School had become, for all practical purposes, a segregated school. And in 1966, we went to the school board, again the Hayes School Neighborhood Association, and requested the desegregation of Hayes School. That was also a difficult situation.
Okay, how about
doing the civil
rights movement? How did it affect the blacks in the community, or you yourself?
I tell you, during the 60s, these are my opinions. With the exception of a few blacks, there was a great deal of complacency in the black community. Of course, I had, at that time, I had two children. My son was born in 57, my daughter in 62, and I at 61, and I had made up my mind that they were not going to be denied any opportunities that were available for white folk. And I guess that was one of the things that spurred me on into doing some of the things that I was doing, because I also knew that anything that I did for my children had to help other children as well. But there was a great deal of complacency. For an example, well, I gave the example when I said I was going to run for city council, I was told by many black folks that I couldn't be elected. When we decided to go to the school board and desegregate the schools, it required busing of black children. And many of the black parents were irate about having to get up and put their kids on buses. And I could understand to a degree their concern. But on the other hand, if you're paying taxes and you know full well that the teachers at the school to which your kids are going are one, as I always identify them, the bottom of the barrel, two, that your kids are not getting the same kind of education that you see across the board for other kids, that's no time to be complacent. And I took a lot of flack about what we did as far as desegregating schools. I don't know, as I look back in retrospect, I don't know if it's good or bad, but at that point in time, to me, it was the right thing to do, and that's why I pursued it.
During the time you were director at Douglas Center, I was wondering about the young blacks, were they motivated more during that time?
I want to think they were. The family structure in the mid-50s and early 60s was a little different than as you see it from, say, 65 up until now. I knew all the young kids, and we had I coached basketball for Willard School and Marquette School at that time, and I had certain criteria that the young fellows had to meet. We won all the basketball championships, we won all the football championships, but they had to meet my criteria. One was that we showered after every game, you had a clean towel, you had a clean t-shirt. And within the center itself, I had certain rules and regulations also. When you came through but I don't know if you're familiar with the old Douglas Center. Okay, when you walked through the double doors, if you were a young fellow and you were wearing a hat, the hat came off. And we had regularly scheduled programs. We had roller skating, we had our basketball leagues, we had adult classes. As I look back at the 6 years I spent there and look at what occurred thereafter, and not knocking the individuals who took over after I left the center. And I think if you talk to any of the, say, those individuals who are 30, 35 years old now, that they'll tell you there was a distinct difference in the way the center was ran when I was director then what occurred after that. It appeared to me to lost control, and these are my own opinions. There was a lot of gang banging going on during that time, so that had to have a direct effect on what was going on. But there was gang banging going on when I was director also. But it was my theory that you don't ask anyone to do anything that you yourself can't or won't do. And that's the way, you know, anything that went on in the center, I participated in. And that's why I feel that I kept a pretty good handle on what was going on. During the mid-60s, when all the gangbanging was going on, there were only two people in the community that could, we had five different gangs in the community. And there was only two people in the community that could move in and out of those gangs, and that was myself and Reverend Offit. In 1968, two gangs, Satan Lovers and the Sons of Satan, I don't know if those are familiar names, But they decided they were going to go out to the stadium on the 4th of July and just tear up the stadium. And I know you heard of Cornelius Horton. Okay, Cornelius was killed in 72 or 73, I'm not sure. But anyhow, I called Cornelius, and the other fellow, his name was Jones. I called them together, and we met down to my lower level to about 3 o'clock in the morning on July 3rd. Because, you know, it would not done them any good, nor anyone else any good, to go out to the stadium and raise a lot of hell. So they decided, and very seldom you saw two gangs coalescing either. Generally, you know, they stand alone. In fact, they were generally fighting each other. But they came together and bought a pig, roasted a pig the next day, and had them a pig roast. When you get 25, 30 young fellows together, and it's difficult, it's a difficult thing to control, but I was talking about who?
About the game.
Yeah,
about the game. Well, and the games, you know, they continued through and up through the mid 70s. It took a little different perspective. They did recruiting. It must have been in 75 or 76. And they did coalesce. They came together and called themselves the Peacestone Nation. Did a lot of recruiting of younger kids, and became really difficult because they were using forceful tactics in trying to get kids to join up in the gangs. Then, you know, the tragedy of Cornelius getting shot. Because let me tell you, if you're capable of leading a group of young men who have the tendencies of gangbanging, then you have to have a whole hell of a lot of leadership ability. And it's a shame that people like Cornelius, Terry Townsend, Stevie Jackson, it's a shame that their energies were not directed in a different manner. When Cornelius got shot, Terry Townsend came to me, and we sat down and talked for hours, because they were about, Stevie Jackson shot Cornelius, and they were about the business of going to get Stevie Jackson. And I kept telling Terry, you know, that will not help at all. And in fact, you know, it will get you into trouble and everyone else. Finally, Terry began to recognize what I was trying to say to him. Terry too had leadership abilities. Terry, since then, has finished school. I'm not sure what Terry is doing right now. You lose track of the young men, but that when Cornelius was shot, you could see the gangs beginning to subside, and things got back to normal.
Questions I'd like to know the day that you was born in Washington.
Born July 24th, 1930. 53 years old. I was 53 years old a week ago Sunday.
Can you remember why? Did your parents ever tell you why they moved to something?
Not really, but the general theory is that people who migrated north felt that the opportunities in the north were better than they were in the south. As I said before, I don't think that the opportunities were any greater, because the prejudice here was just as bad, if not worse, because it was a subtle type of prejudice. In the south, you clearly know what you can do. north, they'll let you walk into a restaurant, only, this is years ago, and only tell, only for the purpose of telling you after you get ready to sit down that we don't serve black people in the restaurant. Well, in the South, you knew better. You had your places to go, you had your water fountains to drink from. Not true in the North. But I would assume that my mother and father moved north because they felt that the opportunities were better.
Can you remember some of the names of the restaurant here that you arrived at Black Street?
Well, it used to be one right on the corner of Wright and Green Street, where the U of I drugstore is now. It was Hanley's restaurant. Now, you know, blacks could work in the restaurant, but blacks couldn't eat in the restaurant. And all up and down Wright Street, there were restaurants. And of course, that was, you know, that was before, well, it really wasn't before my time either, because I was enrolled in school out here. But it was Hanley's. There used to be a restaurant around the corner on 6th Street, Prins. Well, it used to be a restaurant called Prins on Green. You couldn't eat there. They then moved around on 6th Street. But basically, none of the restaurants on campus would serve black students. You couldn't get haircuts out here. Only when J.C. Caroline came. J.C., as you know, was an All-American football player, and you don't really do a whole heck of a lot to an All-American football player. And J.C. broke the color barrier as far as blacks being able to get their haircuts cut on campus. Clearly, white folk didn't know much about cutting black folk hair, but it was just, you know, the principle of the thing. That, you know, you're here in school. This allegedly is one of the greater universities in the United States, or in the world. And how can you, being an athlete or just being a student here, be denied those kinds of opportunities? I recall, too, going back to my first time on city council. I was on city council two different times. First time on the city council, we had no human relations ordinance. Strangely enough, the year that I was elected to the city council, they were also building Lincoln Square, and they were also building a new city building. Myself and another alderman by the name of Gene Gilmore. Gene is a Quaker by religion, a very nice guy, and we started pushing for our human relations ordinance. We did get the president of Carson Perry Scott to endorse the ordinance, but it didn't pass. And nothing was done until, I think, 71 or 72. In reference to passing a human relations ordinance. But, you know, you got to plant a seed, and while we were disappointed that this didn't occur at that period of time, at least the seed was planted in fruition thereafter. But the city of Urbana was very backward, very backward.
You stated that you were the only black, you were also the first black on the city council.
That's right, first black, and I was elected in 65, I think, 64, 65. 2 years, every 2 years within the ward, you have an aldermanic election. The following, 2 years after I was elected, I encouraged Fred Walden to run as for alderman also from the third ward, and Fred won 2 years after I won. Fred came in and he won also. So at that time we had two black aldermen from the third ward. Fred stayed on the council. I had to leave the council when I was appointed director of the poverty program. I had to resign my position as alderman because of conflict of interest. As director of the poverty program, I had to deal with the Urbana City Council, the Champaign City Council, and County Board. And sitting on the council and having to vote on various issues that involved the poverty program was conflict of interest, so I had to leave the council. I ran again in 1970, 1972 and was elected again in 72. I also ran for mayor in 1968. Just for the purposes of letting the community know that black people don't think any differently from white people. It's my opinion that had we did what you call the bullet vote, that I could have been elected mayor of the city of Urbana. The lady, I ran in the primary against Jean Marie Wilde. She beat me by 28 votes in the primary. Had my ward supported me the way that I knew that they could have, I could have beaten her in the primary. The general election might have been a different story. But black folks did not vote the bullet ballot. And as a result, she beat me in her ward by going into the last counting. I was leading her by something like 70 votes until her ward came in. And she ended up beating me by 28 votes.
How do you feel about the involvement that the black community has played in government? Are there active now than they were back in the time?
No, I really think that in looking at today and comparing what was going on in the late 50s and early 60s, we have basically lost ground as far as I'm concerned. You don't have any black individuals as far as Urbana is concerned in the political arena. There's no one on city council. We tend to be fairly active in party politics. We have one person on the school board. Oh, I should mention also, back in the mid-60s, at one time, Taylor Thomas had ran for school board and was soundly defeated. In the late 60s, Evelyn Burnett ran for school board, and this is the one time that I saw the black community really come together. And she was elected. In my opinion, did a super job, was re-elected two or three more times. And which made a whole lot of difference in what your school board did also. It's strange when you have someone on the inside that can bring the message out. It makes a lot of difference than you going to a meeting and not knowing what has gone on behind closed doors. And I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that society is not going to give us anything unless we go after it. And the only way you can know what to go after is to have someone on the inside who knows what's going on the inside. But then you've got to support that person also. Because it gets very lonely to be standing up there saying that you're speaking for a group of people and look behind you and ain't nobody there. It gets very lonely. And I'm sure as it was with me, that on many occasions, Evelyn felt the same way. And you know, you get a select few people who will continue to go and do what they think is right. And for some reason or another, it seems to me, for some reason or another, that select few people are always the ones who are being called upon to do certain kinds of things. We need, as a black people, we need to spread this across more than 6 or 8 or 9 people. And that's the way it's been in the black community for a period of time. You have a select group of people who will take the leadership role and hopefully will get some stragglers who will help them. And you know, those select people get burnt out. That was my case. You know, I'd been out there for 15 years, and in 1974, when I resigned from city council, I'd made up my mind at that point in time that I was going to do some of the things that Paul Hersey thought he wanted to do, and not the things that everybody else thought Paul Hersey should be doing. You can get burned out, and you know, like I say, it's pretty lonely out there when you look back and you're out there doing and saying all these things. You look back and you don't have anybody standing behind you.
Coalition
that
was here. Did you have any involvement
with them? That was a strange phenomenon. Reverend Offit and I went to the Methodist Synod, but to the it was a religious affiliation. We had written a program where all of the black organizations would come together, and for purposes of improving the education, the employment, would coalesce for that purpose. We needed $6,000 or $7,000 to one, set up an office, to hire someone to serve as the director. We called it BACUP, Black Action Council for United Progress. And it was Urban League and Community Council for Integration, NAACP. We had all the black organizations that we had put into this one group, and for the purposes, as I say, for education and employment primarily. Well, Reverend Offit and I went to this Senate meeting and presented our program, and they funded the program. Then he and I kind of stepped aside. The next thing we knew, and of course, I had my problems with Stevie Jackson and with Roy Williams, and because of my approach versus their approach. John Lee Johnson at that time was with Roy and Stevie, and they were young fellows. And I won't knock anything they've done, because they've done a whole hell of a lot for this community. But they did not like my approach, which was the quiet kind of back in the room kind of approach, and unless I had to get up and just yell and scream. And I didn't particularly like their approach, where they went out and yelled and screamed and stomped and threatened. But believe me, there's a need for both approaches. We organized, we got the money for backup, and then just kind of, Reverend Offit and I just kind of stepped aside. Well, Stevie Jackson was employed as the director. The first office we had was down on 5th Street between Park and University. It used to be an old grain company down there. And that's where the first office was. And, backup at that time did not do what we had perceived should be done. And for about a year or so, I remained, I guess if you call it, a member of BACUP. But when things started going in the opposite direction, I disassociated myself with BACUP. But that was a strange thing. At that time, I was probably so far away from. See, mostly my involvement was in the Urbana, the city of Urbana area, and like I said, Ernie Westfield and Roy, Ernie Westfield, John Lee Johnson, they pretty much Kenny Stratton, they pretty much were involved with the city of Champaign. Occasionally, I would attend a council meeting in Champaign, but only if there was something jointly going on that affected both Champaign and Urbana. But you're right, you know, back in, I remember when I first came back to the university after I had been director of the poverty program, I was hired as a personnel officer recruiter. During the year that I was a director of the poverty program, I had set up two substations out in the community, and we had two personnel people from the university that came out on Tuesdays and Thursdays to interview and test black people in the community, because this is a civil service system here. And when I came back, I maintained those two places in the community, and I interviewed and I tested black people in the community, and then brought their scores back to the university. I then, after serving as a personnel officer for that 1 year, the university then changed their organizational structure to a chancellorship, and Jack Peltison was brought back as the chancellor for the Urbana campus. I was then appointed affirmative action officer for the Urbana campus. We went through a period of time where when I first got involved in personnel, we had something like 330 black people working here at the university, and about 90% of them were in the food service area. In 68, I instituted a program, a clerical learner program, which is still functioning. We did that initially through a TATE program that we purchased from a company out of Chicago. And you had the opportunity to learn at your own speed. I also did a program, what we call a pre-apprentice training program. And Kenny Stratton at that time was a counselor for Champaign School District. And I went to Kenny and had Kenny to point out young men who showed skills in the carpenter area or whatever area, and who also could meet the minimum requirements for getting into the apprentice program. And what we did was to conduct an 8-week pre-apprentice program, because when you become an apprentice, you have to know math, you have to know what they call spatial concepts, you have to be able to read. And so during that 8 weeks, we went back and did refresher courses in math, we taught spatial concepts, we built what they called a finger dexterity and a manual dexterity board, because these were the tests that were given to qualify you to go into apprentice training. Also, during that year was the biggest year for gang banging. I will never forget this. And I had some young fellows from the Satan Lovers and some young fellows from the Sons of Satan who were going to these classes. And keeping them separate was a very difficult. Well, keeping them from raising hell in the classroom was very difficult. And I remember I used to go out to Douglas Park. We met out here in the Armory. We had two classrooms in the Armory. And I'd go out to Douglas Park with the guy that was assisting me, and we'd pick up these young fellows and bring them out to the university for training. Started out with some 15, and 14 of them completed the program, and 14 were accepted as apprentices, and most of them are still here at the university. And they're making $35,000, $36,000 a year as carpenters, as electricians, as plumbers. In fact, I ran into a young fellow last week. His name is Charles Howard. And I don't know if you know him, but when I knew Charles, he was about as big as you are. And he walked up to me and said, "You don't remember me, Mr. Hersey, do you?" I said, "I sure don't." He said, "You did one of the best things that ever happened." I said, "What's that?" He said, "That apprentice program." And I'm just talking. I said, "Who are you anyhow?" Yeah, Charles Howard. I said, "My God, he must weigh like 240 pounds. But I didn't recognize him. But it's those kinds of things that when you look back, it made me feel good inside to know that here's a young man. And he said to me, he said, "You know, I'm making about $35,000 a year now." I said, "That's super." But it's those kinds of things that when you look back that make you, there's a warm feeling that goes through you when someone comes up and says that to you.
Yes, I just told you my question. Your wife's name is David, too.
Okay. My wife's name, Shirley Treadwell Hersey. We were married August 22nd, 1955. I have two children, Charisse. Charisse is 22 years old, and son Paul Jr. is 26. And I've got one grandson, Paul III, and he's 3 years old.
How has the community changed since you've been here, and what improvements would you like to see in the future?
Well, I think there's been a definite change in the community just during my lifetime here. As I say, going back to when I first started the school, it was an integrated school, then it went to a segregated school, and went back to an integrated school. And my understanding now is that King School, which is located in the black community, is probably the top school in the Urbana School District, and primarily because you have people from all countries, all races. It's the school itself is a world school for all practical purposes. Of course, you have open housing now. You have job opportunities are available. You have paved streets. You know, when I was young, you had dirt roads. You have paved streets pretty much in most of the community. I think the opportunity for black people to succeed is there if black people take advantage of it. And nobody's going to give you, it's going to give you something, you know. And this theory of the world owes us something, I buy to a degree. I think that the racial situation compared to, say, 20 years ago is really stalemated up. I think there's still a great deal of institutional racism. I think we are a little more aware of the institutional racism and we can deal with it a little differently than we did 20 years ago. But it's still there. I think if you look at the University of Illinois in reference to one education, it's opened up more for black students. Of course, the housing is completely different. The employment is completely different. There have been some changes. Still a long way to go, though. And, you know, it's going to take young kids like you who need to continue to do some of the things. Older, you know, it's strange. Many of the younger kids really don't recognize what their mothers and fathers went through in order for them to be where they are now. We have taken a lot of criticism for either not doing or what we have done not being the right things. But if you sit back and you don't do anything, then there's not going to be any change at all. And like I say, you know, you can point to people like Fred Walden, Elvin Burnett, Stevie Jackson, Roy Williams, John Lee Johnson, going way back, Mr. Phillips, who initially started the housing area at Carver Park. You know, these are the kind of people who, during their period of time, did what they could do within society at that time. And some recognition has to be given to those people. You know, it might have been very small, but without that kind of leadership, even during that period of time, we would never have been as far as we are now. That's my opinion.
What improvement would you like to see?
Well, that's a difficult question, really. There has to be a more
Toby isn't in today,
firstly, we're going to get more involved, have to get back into the political and educational system more so than we are now, because it's my opinion, the Urbana City Council in particular has reduced the numbers to 7. And it's going to be more difficult for a black to get elected in the third ward, which for all practical purposes is predominantly black. I don't know if we've reached a period of time when complacency has overtaken the activities that we saw before, but we definitely need to have someone on the Urbana City Council to speak for us, because I'm sure it's not going to happen if we depend on people like Frieda Weischer, who's our representative right now. Carlos is having all kinds of difficulty on the school board. Probably need someone to run for school board in addition to Carlos for support there. I think it's clear that the people who are serving on the school board, at least at the present time, really have no concern about black students. Within the Urbana school district itself, we need more black administrators. Dr. Young has just been really railroaded out of his position as principal, and there has to be more support for people like Dr. Young. There is, for all practical purposes, there is open housing, but when you start talking about being able to purchase a house in another area, then in order to do that, you've got to have a decent job. And without a decent job, the ability to move outside of the black community becomes negligible. So, we've got to continue to work towards getting black people who have the background, education, and training into positions where these things can fall into place. The open housing is not... Those kinds of things that I would like to see change in the community. I think we need to stress to our young adults that, as I said before, without proper training, without the proper education, society's not going to give you anything. And it appears that it's going to be even tighter with the present, economic status of this country, and with the leadership that we have as well. And you're going to do it for yourself, otherwise it won't get done.
Since you brought up the subject of Dr. Young, I was wondering, the church is supporting him and giving him money, for legal fees or whatever. And I was wondering if that church, churches have been, like that all, they've been supportive of people who try to...
That's a good question. I recall when I ran for city council. I know you heard of Brother Billy. Okay. Brother Billy told his congregation that they were not to get involved in any political type of activity. And he had a large congregation. So if that's their beliefs, I have nothing against that. But in order for black people to survive, the church is basically the base from which you have power. We tend to be a very religious race. Our numbers you can find in the church, and without, my opinion, without the leadership from that individual who heads that church, God didn't tell you to sit back and he's going to do everything for you. And if you don't get out there and do something for yourself, and if you have ministers who are telling you, don't get involved in this and don't get involved in that, there. We'll live and we'll suffer from here on out. Because let's face it, the church for years has been the backbone of the black community. And if your leadership in the church is telling you not to get involved in things that affect your daily life, then you know the opportunity of improving it is almost nil. Back in the, well, when I was running for city council, I had pretty much the support from the black churches. We had, at that time, we had some very, well, Reverend Ramsey was a minister at Bethel Church as a young fellow and had been very active in Cairo, Illinois, and then in the black movement down there. So, and that's the church I was going to at that time, so I had good support there. The Baptist Church, well, I had good support because Reverend Offutt was here and he was active in the community. And but it's difficult. We as people tend to separate church and state too much when it comes to those kind of things. I think if anything, we should have learned a lesson from what happened in Chicago, where black people finally coalesce and put a black mayor in, even though he's having all kind of difficulty. At least that should be an example for everybody across the country, that if you band together, that you can accomplish those kinds of things. And the church is not a place for anyone to tell other people that their daily lives are being affected by a political institution that denies them many of the things that the church says God's going to give you, because God ain't going to give you that. No, I can't think of anything that probably after you leave I will, but I think it's very good that an effort is being made to give some background and history of the black community here in Champaign-Urbana, and two of you are to be commended for doing this. I'd be very pleased if my grandson could come back 20 years from now and say, you know, this is my grandfather, and he did this, and he'll have a record to go by. It's very good.
Well, thank you.